Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated war episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, politicians, historians, and we talk about wars in history. Today's guest is Tim Bouverie, a British historian, a former political journalist for Channel 4 News, and he's a Sunday Times bestselling author and author of today's book, Allies at War, How the Struggles Between the Allied Powers Shaped the War and the World. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Emily. It's a great pleasure.
Yes. So this is pretty cool, where I've always had this idea about, you know, you see the famous picture of Stalin, FDR, Winston Churchill, and you have this kind of idea immediately about who these guys are. But this book kind of takes us into behind what you might initially see just kind of browsing and reading about them. Can you tell us a little bit about what readers are going to see in the book about these guys?
Well, the first thing to say is it's not just about these guys. We think about the Second World War being dominated by the big three, Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, Britain, America, and the Soviet Union. But they weren't the only players. And the only reason they became the mighty alliance that they eventually became was because that the first alliance, allied alliance of the Second World War collapsed, which was the Anglo-French alliance. Nobody predicted this. Nobody expected this. The Anglo-French alliance and the French army had held the Germans for 4 years during the First World War. So it was a really shocking event and necessitated an enormous recalibration of alliances and global politics. So although the book does focus overwhelmingly on the big three, Churchill, Roosevelt, Stalin, Britain, America, and the Soviet Union, I also have chapters on the British alliance with the French, the relationship with General de Gaulle and the Free French, nationalist China. Roosevelt often spoke about the Big Four. Americans had a deep affinity with the Chinese, who had been battling against the Japanese since 1937. That's in the book. The Polish agony is closely examined, as are partisan struggles in Yugoslavia and Greece. So the attempt, or rather the scope of the book, is to have a complete history of the anti-Axis alliance. And then within that, to dig beneath the famous photographs and to try and examine how relations really existed. And that means accepting the contradictions and the conflicts, as well as the cooperation. Allies at war is an obvious double entendre, because while these allies were obviously working together militarily to defeat Hitler and Imperial Japan, they were at odds over a vast range of issues, from global strategy to the future peace and the sort of world that they wanted to create out of the ashes of this most destructive of wars.
Yeah, I always found that kind of thing fascinating, where at first glance, you might be like, oh, they all got along and they were allies. But really, that's not really the case, where there's all this interesting tensions and drama and, you know, sometimes really conflicting things going on behind the scenes. So if you could characterize, let's say, just before World War II, characterize the British relationship with the U.S., how was that different once we teamed up with them in World War II? What would you say?
Well, I think it's very easy to forget, or in fact has been forgotten, that relations between Britain and the U.S. weren't very good during the 1930s. The U.S. and the British were commercial rivals, and this was keenly felt on both sides of the Atlantic. While the U.S. was very critical of Britain's policy of appeasement, the appeasement of Hitler as practiced by British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. The lack of cordiality between the British and the Americans in the diplomatic sphere extended to such an extent that Neville Chamberlain, who was Britain's prime minister when the war broke out in September of 1939, right through to the start of the Battle of France on the 10th of May 1940, he didn't even want America to fight alongside Britain in this war, alongside Britain and France. And he was very explicit about this. Well, firstly, it's a fantastical idea. It's never going to happen. Roosevelt has declared neutrality. Sure. All of the neutrality acts of the 1930s have been invoked. But Chamberlain says, in a letter to his sisters, I don't want the Americans to fight for us. We should have to pay too high a price at the peace table for this. And what he means is that he knows full well that the US administration has very clear set aims with regard to the dismantling of the British Empire, and in particular, the system of tariffs, which then protected the British Empire. In those days, in the 1930s and 1940s, the US was extremely anti-tariffs, and it was the British who had a system of tariffs to try and protect their empire.
Yeah, and it's kind of, I mean, we're so far removed from things like the territorial disputes of the 19th century with Britain throughout the 19th century about all these different territories in the U.S. that we were still kind of squabbling about who gets Oregon and all this stuff. And then it's still, like you were saying, it kind of morphed into this economic rivalry with Britain. But we tend to think, oh, we've always just been like really good friends with them after the revolution. And that's not really the case.
It's like a family. There's a strong cultural link.
Yeah.
Particularly strong in the south of America. In fact, if you look at opinion polls between September 1939 and Pearl Harbor, it is the southern states that overwhelmingly favor American intervention. And isolationism is strongest in the north and midwest in industrial towns. And there are all sorts of reasons for that, dating right back to the Civil War. But the American view of the British was that they were imperialist, they were snobbish, they were conceited, their society was antiquated, it was sharply divided between the classes, and that the British themselves were, I think the expression is, too clever by half. That the British were the long practiced practitioners of balance of power diplomacy and secret deals and always looking at the international situation from the perspective of their own interests, their own international commercial imperial benefits. And so there was a huge amount of distrust of British war aims and indeed British war effort in the early part of the war. This is where we get the phrase from, the phony war. This is a phrase which is coined by the highly isolationist senator William Borah, who said there's something phony going on here, because the first 6 or 7 months of the war were characterized by very little fighting.
Yeah, and it's so fascinating how things could have gone down differently. Nothing was really, you often find in war in history, nothing was inevitable. And I love that you have this really, this spanning global cover of how everything went down and how it all fell into place. So would you say that this is kind of like a, I almost get this sense of these huge, I want to say egos, but it's not quite egos, it's personalities, like these just huge personalities that have to come together and they sort of trust each other, but they don't trust each other. Is that kind of an accurate picture of what we're talking about, the big three here?
Yes, I think it is. And I don't think that it's wrong to use the word ego. Stalin had developed a cult of personality about himself in the Soviet Union. And Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill had extremely healthy egos. I think one of the reasons for the deterioration of the Churchill-Roosevelt relationship as the war went on was Roosevelt's increasing assertion of himself as the senior partner of the Allies, and Churchill finding this harder and harder to accept, but also FDR's part about how Churchill, on a practical level, was able to travel around the world, meeting Stalin, visiting battlefields, engaging in face-to-face diplomacy in a way that the American-bound wheelchair-bound president could not. And particularly with Roosevelt, I think, in respect to Churchill, that went on. This, however, I don't think is fundamental. These are the relationships that could exist domestically within any cabinet at the top of politics. What is fundamental is that these three men have fundamentally different ideas about how the war should be prosecuted and about what sort of world should emerge in its aftermath.
Aha, yes. And just to kind of touch a little on that rivalry or jealousy between FDR and Churchill, would you say that played a little bit of part in what was the whole humiliating Churchill, FDR humiliating Churchill in front of Stalin situation? Did that really happen?
Well, I write in the book that I think that everything that you can say about FDR, you can also say the opposite. So he was, on the one hand, the most warm and charming man you could ever hope to meet. And yet he was also extremely cold and even brutal at times. He was one of the great idealists of the 20th century, and yet he was also a consummate politician and indeed a deep cynic. He had an extraordinary capacity to empathize with and seek to help the destitute, not just in the United States, but in other parts of the world. And yet he had a very strong sense of himself as a patrician and had, frankly, a fetish for European royalty who were in exile in the US. With Churchill, he does have this warm relationship, but he could also take a certain delight in teasing Churchill, making Churchill feel uncomfortable. And his strategy at Tehran, which is the first time the big three have met all together in November of 1943, his strategy to curry favor with Stalin is to flaunt his differences with Churchill. He does this in private with Stalin. He talks about British imperialism. He talks about Britain's unwillingness to cross the Channel and invade France as the Americans and the Soviets wish. And then in public, he repeatedly needles Churchill about his imperialism, about his habits, about his smoking of cigars, about John Bull, about all sort of quaint British characteristics. And Stalin laughs. But I think what Stalin was really enjoying was not so much FDR's humor as the realization that the democracies, the Western powers, were not united and that he would be able to exploit their divisions.
Yeah, and I wonder how much plays into the fact that he, at the beginning of the war, had this pact with Germany where it was even more mistrusting, where they're like, they did not like each other, but they were allied, and then they weren't. And so I wonder how he was feeling, kind of like, oh, I'm a little bit more secure here and everybody kind of needs me here. Everybody's trying to win me onto their side.
Absolutely true. Stalin sees everything as a transaction. He doesn't believe in something for nothing. Roosevelt, at one stage in 1943, is talking to the former U.S. ambassador to Moscow, William Bullitt, and he speculates, or really more than speculates, he airs his view that he can get along with Stalin and the U.S. can get along with Soviet Russia if he is generous with Stalin and asks for nothing in return. He thinks that Stalin's security demands for a sphere of influence in Eastern Europe at the end of the war are legitimate, and that if he gives this to Stalin, then Stalin will work with him for a world of international security and great power cooperation. Whereas Bullitt replies and says, Mr. President, Stalin is a Caucasian bandit whose only thought when he gets something for nothing is that the other fellow is an ass. So the idea that the Western powers are disunited and also cynical and avaricious greatly delights Stalin. He offers the British in early meetings European territory. He likes the idea of a carve-up, such as he had with Hitler. He suggests that the British might like to take back ports in France and the Low Countries to guarantee their security, which of course would suit him, because if the British take European territory, then he could take as much as he likes. And everything is, he thinks everyone is out for something. When Churchill compliments him in Moscow on the goldfish that he has at his dacha, Stalin immediately says, Would you like them for breakfast? He sees everything as a trade. Everything is everyone coveting everyone else's territory, sphere of influence, assets. And it
probably part of the reason he was so easily able to get rid of people that were close to him, too, is they were all just transactionary.
Yeah, I think that's part of it.
That definitely sounds about right about him. And is this where the whole Uncle Joe kind of, he's our friend, he's our America's uncle kind of propaganda piece came out about him during the war? Is that the desire to make him feel like, ooh, you're super close with us and we can be buddies?
Well, Uncle Joe was a private nickname which Churchill and FDR had for Stalin, but it should be said, deployed with heavy irony. They still called him UJ or Uncle Joe when he was being extremely bloody-minded towards them both. But it is fascinating, as you say, Emily, how swiftly British and American public opinion, which was very hostile to the Soviet Union from long before the Second World War, and particularly hostile to the Soviet Union when Stalin was allied with Hitler, which he was between August of 1939, right up until Hitler turned on him in June of 1941. We should remember that the only reason Soviet Russia ends up on the right or winning side of the Second World War is because Hitler invades the Soviet Union. But very swiftly, the enthusiasm for the USSR and the deeds of the Red Army, which are able to check the Wehrmacht before the gates of Moscow, and then produce this amazing victory at Stalingrad in the winter of 1942-1943, this sends the West absolutely delirious with pro-Soviet fever. And there's very little discussion in the West of the internal regime in the USSR. There's no discussion of the repression, the police state, the purges, even things which come up during the war, such as the revelation that there have been some 21,000 Polish prisoners of war taken in September of 1939, who have been executed, shot in the back of the head, and buried in the Katyn forest. It's the Germans who discover these bodies when they are at Smolensk in March, April of 1943 and publish this fact. The British, and to a lesser extent the Americans, are convinced that these Poles have been murdered by the Soviets. But in the interests of the alliance, and in the interests of not outraging their own public opinions against their vital ally, the USSR, they go along with the Kremlin-spun fiction that it was the Germans and not the Soviets who had murdered these Poles.
That's awful. And it is kind of interesting where people who know about World War II, you know, even just a little bit, will know just how much Russia gave to the war, just how vital and crucial they were, how many people they lost. And that's why they still call it the Great Patriotic War over there to this day. But I think that on our side of things today, that is underplayed a little bit. God, how many was it, like 20 million people or something like that, that they lost in the war?
I think the current estimates are that the Soviet Union lost 26 to 27 million people during the Second World War. The British and the Americans lost fewer than 1 million servicemen and women combined.
Yeah, the U.S. lost about 500,000.
Yes.
A little over 500,000, I think. Yeah, and so I think that it's generally not emphasized how crucial they actually were. It's easy to kind of criticize, Stalin's this terrible person, but we're kind of cozying up to him. But we really needed Russia in that war. Do you think that on the other side of things over there, U.S. and British contribution is kind of swept under the rug a little bit about how crucial we were in different ways?
Absolutely. We're all far too nationalist in the way that we view the Second World War. A couple of things to say about the Soviet contribution and these extraordinary statistics, as you around 26 to 27 million. The vast majority of those who died were civilians. Not vast majority, but the majority. I think it's around 10 million Soviet soldiers and personnel. Why are casualty figures so high on the Eastern Front? Well, it is undoubtedly true that the vast majority of the Wehrmacht, Hitler's army, and Luftwaffe are deployed over there. But a lot of this is also due to errors by Stalin. He allows his troops to be captured. He allows them to be annihilated because he doesn't understand the concept of a strategic retreat in the summer, both of 1941 and 1942. So whole armies are completely destroyed. He's cavalier about Russian loss of life. He's also got the NKVD, the Soviet secret police, which are lined up with machine guns behind the Russian lines, ready to shoot anyone who retreats. So some of these casualties are reflecting his own extremely brutal war practice. And then, of course, the war in the East is so much more savage than the war in the West because it is a war of annihilation. It is a racial war. Hitler has briefed his generals, and the Wehrmacht is completely on board with this, that the Slavs who live in the Soviet Union are Untermensch. They are not proper, full human beings of the same caliber as the Aryans, and this is a war to destroy them, not just to conquer them or to defeat them militarily. But at the same time,
to make room for the German
people. To make room for German people in the East, and to improve the to improve the racial stock of the world in the Nazis' extremely warped racial paradigm. But the British and the American contribution to the war is also extremely important, and it's not recognized in Russia. When Putin has his annual military parade, there's very little discussion of the fact that the trucks which transported the Red Army from Stalingrad all the way to Berlin were American trucks, and that the food which kept the Red Army from starving was Spam, which was made in Minnesota. If Britain and the United States had not supplied the Soviet Union with vast quantities of material throughout 41 right through to 1945, then it's highly unlikely the Soviet Union could have continued the war. And it's also pretty unlikely that the Soviet Union could have defeated the Axis single-handed were it not for the need for the Germans and the Italians and the Japanese, who, let's not forget, had been fighting the Russians right at the beginning of the Second World War in 1939, mainly skirmish battles, could have combined against Stalin. It was a close-run thing, and all allies needed each other.
It's very much an interlocking puzzle, I would say. But it is interesting how we kind of downplay, everybody downplays, you know, the other side of the world's involvement.
Mm. I gave an interview for an American television channel on the 75th anniversary of D-Day 6 or so years ago. And the piece which I saw before it purely mentioned, it was as if D-Day was an entirely American operation, whereas, of course, there was British troops and Canadian troops and Australian troops storming the Normandy beaches as well. But we're all guilty of this. I mean, I think in Britain we've become much more aware of the contributions of other players, particularly the Soviet Union, in recent decades. The American contribution has always been acknowledged. And it is in its nature that people have their own national myths, which they like to cling on to.
Yeah, you kind of go like, okay, you know. Can we talk a little bit about the Yalta Conference and what that was and what happened to Poland that readers are going to see in the book?
Of course. So Yalta was the last wartime conference of the big three Allied war leaders while the war was going on. There is a subsequent conference once the European war has ended at Potsdam. But by that stage, not only has Germany been defeated, but Roosevelt is dead and Harry Truman is president. At the Yalta Conference, there are all sorts of discussions, but the primary aim of Roosevelt is still the prosecution of the war. And this is a war not just against Germany, but also against Japan. Roosevelt is determined to bring the Soviet Union into the war against Japan. The atomic bomb has not yet been tested. He doesn't know that he's got this ace up his sleeve. And so he makes a territorial deal with Stalin behind Churchill's back and behind the back of his Chinese ally, Chiang Kai-shek, to reward Stalin with territory in the Far East in exchange for Soviet belligerency against Japan once Germany has been defeated. The most contentious issue at the Yalta Conference is Poland. Poland is the country for whom Britain nominally went to war. In September 1939, Britain and France declared war on Germany because Germany had invaded Poland, a country Britain and France had guaranteed. Now, there is nothing actually intrinsic about Poland which caused Britain and France to go to war. I firmly believe that if Poland had been first on the German agenda and Czechoslovakia second, then Poland would have been sold out in a Munich-style agreement, just as Czechoslovakia was. The reason Britain and France really went to war was because Hitler had proven beyond all possible doubt that he could not be trusted and that he was out for European and potentially global hegemony. Nevertheless, the British feel a great sense of debt to Poland, moral debt, and both the British and the Americans have been consistent in their propaganda and in their own hearts. The Allies have made great play about the idea that they are fighting for a way of life, for a democratic way of life where people can live without fear of secret police, without fear of invasion, without fear of oppression. Yeah. And the idea that Poland, this country which was invaded in 1939, thus beginning the Second World War, and has suffered pretty much more than any other country. It's been the epicenter of the Holocaust. It was divided between the Germans and the Soviets in September, both sides perpetrating appalling atrocities. The idea that Poland is going to be subjugated by the Soviet Union is absolutely unconscionable to Winston Churchill in particular. The trouble is that by the time of the Yalta Conference in February of 1945, the Red Army is already in possession of Poland. And there is pretty much nothing the British and the Americans can do or would do to drive them out. Churchill fantasizes in 1945 about a joint American-British operation to push the Red Army back to Russia's natural frontiers. But this, for reasons we've discussed, could never possibly happen. British and American public opinion wouldn't wear the idea of another war against an emerging superpower, one that was our gallant allies as far as they were concerned, as well as being profoundly militarily impractical. So all Churchill and Roosevelt can really do at Yalta is plead for Poland. And Churchill is consistent in this, and he receives some pretty half-hearted support from FDR. Because I said, FDR's priority number one is to get the Soviet Union into the war against Japan. Stalin gives him that promise. And his second priority is to get the Soviet Union to join the new international organization that he is forming, what will become the United Nations. And he also gets Stalin to commit to doing that. And after that, he loses interest to a certain extent. He's also an ill man. And as the conference wears on, the British find the Americans less and less stalwart in insisting on safeguards for Polish independence.
That's a very good summary of all of that. And if somebody knows about World War II, they know, you know, lots of these little bits and things like that, but they don't know everything. What would you hope that readers walk away from after reading your book? What ideas and things do you hope they walk away with?
I would hope that readers who read this book would realize that politics doesn't stop just because war breaks out. Politics continues the whole time. This was a political war, and it was a political war on the Allied side as well, and that so many of the decisions which determined the fate of millions of people, either in combat during the war or thereafter, were determined by the rivalry and the disagreements between the Allied powers, as well as the cooperation. There is an enormous amount of cooperation between the Allied powers. The Anglo-American military alliance, I write in the book, was the most sophisticated, mighty, and successful military alliance in history. Never before has an alliance been so integrated or achieved so much, and those two things are obviously related. But I hope that readers will experience the myriad dilemmas that statesmen had to contend with during the war as they weigh up varying alliances, military expediency versus political principle, varying ideological aims and systems, economics versus battles, and it's an extremely complex process, and yet I hope I've made it intelligible and relatable, even entertaining, by making this a book which relies overwhelmingly on first-hand accounts so that readers can really empathize with the sorts of decisions that leaders, not just Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, but also foreign ministers, secretary of states, U.S. ambassadors, U.S. generals, U.S. military attaches, all of these key figures were having to make at the time. So I hope that it should complicate the story of World War II for readers, and it should add nuance and new facts to which people might not be aware of.
Yes, I love the firsthand accounts. Those are just really the meat of how you understand different points of view and different layers of what happened. So I would agree with all of that, that you do all of that. Once again, Tim Bouverie, author of Allies at War, How the Struggles Between the Allied Powers Shaped the War and the World. It is coming out June 10th, so if you're watching this after June 10th, you can go get it on Amazon or pretty much anywhere that you find books. Tim, thanks again for being here and answering all these questions.
Emily, it's a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, bye.
Goodbye. Thank you.